You are listening to 97.3 LPFM WRIR, and this is Open Source RVA. Today on WRIR's weekly audio news digest, we talk to writer Dale Brumfield about his cover story in the Current Style Weekly about the unsolved murder of local poet Rick Davis. And we'll also have an exit interview with artist, architect, and urban ecologist Lisa Taranto, the founder of Tricycle Gardens. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. Monday marked a small victory for both Richmond City Council member Michelle Mosby and the number of Richmond locals who want to find work but claim their job applications tend to be automatically rejected, those who have been convicted of a felony. The council unanimously approved the ordinance that Mosby piloted, popularly known as Ban the Box, which blocks an initial City of Richmond job application from asking about the applicant's conviction history. Positions considered sensitive, such as those in the police and fire departments, are exempt from this rule, and the city is not barred from conducting background checks or asking after past convictions in follow-up interviews. Speaking with NBC 12, Mosby stated her position that this is not free rein for felons, rather an opportunity. Monday was also the day that Governor Bob McDonnell grafted amendments onto bills meant to prepare Virginia for the coming changes of the federal healthcare law that would prohibit healthcare exchanges from covering abortion. The Federal Level Affordable Care Act, which goes into effect in 2014, already comes with provisions against public funding going to abortion, and state-level Virginia law also disallows public funding of abortions except in rare cases. The McDonnell amendments bar families and individuals from purchasing private insurance plans with their own money if that insurance plan happens to include abortion. The amended bills have yet to become law and are scheduled to be voted on during the General Assembly veto session that starts on April 3rd. McDonnell signed a controversial voter ID law on Tuesday, requiring citizens to present a photo ID in order to vote. The law eliminates utility bills, pay stubs, bank statements, checks, or social security cards, leaving driver's license, voter ID cards, student IDs, and concealed handgun permits as acceptable. Republican proponents of the new law say that it will help reduce voter fraud and that the Commonwealth will provide free photo IDs for those without them, while Democrats see it as a blatant tactic to disenfranchise minority and elderly voters and as a return to a pre-civil rights era poll tax. While the photo ID itself is free, many of the documents citizens would need to get it will cost a fee. With only one cited instance of ID voter manipulation in Virginia since 2000. At the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts tonight, it's Secretly Y'all's Southern Culture Gone Noir event. Join a heady bunch of Richmond storytellers, including Guar's Dave Brocky, Randy Bly, the Flame of God, and our own Chris Dovey, as they relay narratives inspired by Jim Jarmusch's classic film, Down by Law. The Tall Tales and Tom Waits music will begin at 6 p.m. For more details, go to secretlyyall.com.
Local poet Rick Davis was brutally murdered 30 years ago in a tragic case that has never been solved. My guest today, writer Dale Brumfield, looks into the case that the Richmond Police has kept open since 1983, when the poet was killed at his job at a now-defunct bookstore on Broad Street. Dale's cover story, The Blood of a Poet, in this week's Style Weekly, not only takes a look at the unusual nature of the unsolved crime, but also paints a vivid picture of the Richmond underground art and poetry scene from the late 60s to the early 80s. Rick Davis was front and center in that bohemian community. He was a published poet, a fanzine publisher, and when times were particularly tough, a porno book author. But who was he really, and why has his murderer never been brought to justice? Dale Brumfield, who's a published author and short story writer and a former co-founder of Throttle Magazine, is here with us today on Open Source RVA to talk about the story. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you for having me, Don.
You're currently working on a book for the History Press?
Correct, yes.
On Richmond's countercultural media. Did you uncover this story of Rick Davis while you were working on the book?
I didn't exactly uncover the story so much as was able to expound on it. I had actually remembered this murder back when we were publishing Throttle Magazine in 1983. We had run a cover story on the murder of Rick Davis about 6 months after it actually had occurred. So that was sort of the base point for writing the article. But it was during my research on some of the underground print media of the 60s and early 70s in Richmond that I really found out more about Rick Davis and what his role was in the print media of Richmond. He was quite a character. He was he certainly had a dark side, but he was also a brilliant and very gentle poet.
Mm-hmm. He came from California?
His background is a little bit sketchy. Apparently, he was born near Allentown, Pennsylvania, and was adopted at a very young age. He made his way out to California as a teenager, and he got speaking gigs at the Lighthouse, which is a coffee shop bar in Hermosa Beach, California, which was also
doing poetry.
He was reading, also people like Philip Whalen and Allen Ginsberg were reading poetry at the Lighthouse during those years. So here was this 17, 18-year-old, reciting his poetry alongside greats like that. It was a beat poetry place. Right. And then in 1957... Rick turned up in Washington, D.C., and that's when he met his friend Lester Blackiston for the first time.
A longtime friend.
They formed a friendship that is a little hard to explain. It was a very unusual friendship. Lester was a very volatile personality, harbored a lot of anger, drank heavily.
Prone to fighting,
prone to pulling out a gun at parties and shooting it through the roof of his houseboat where he lived with his wife Lily down in Kanawha. Locks. Rick, on the other hand, tended to keep more to himself, sit in the back of the village restaurant and write poetry. Rick did hang out with some pretty unsavory characters. It turned out he hung around with some convicted criminals. So he had a dark side as well.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit, because your piece gives a lot of insight into the Richmond underground and that seemed to be centered in and around the village restaurant. Talk a little bit about that circle that Davis surrounded himself with.
Yeah, when Davis came to Richmond in 1958, he really ingrained himself very quickly into that block of Gray Street in 1958 and 1959, especially. Very strong beat poetry presence in the RPI Gray Street corridor at that time. Right across the road from the village was another restaurant called Eaton's Inn, and Eaton's actually opened in 1947, and by the mid-late 50s, it had become a hangout for Richmond's gay community, which was also very strong, and people might find that surprising that, that people would come out and go to a place like that that was for that known reputation, but they certainly did. One person who hung out down in Eaton's in the village area told me that Eaton's was divided into thirds. You go into the first part of the restaurant, that's where the avant-garde people hung out. That's where you would find Lester Blackiston and Rick and Tom Robbins and people like that. You go to the second half of the restaurant, that's where the gay men hung out. You go all the way to the back of the restaurant, that's where the lesbians were.
Oh, okay.
So they segregated themselves in Eaton's.
A little like high school.
Yes, a little bit like high school. And then Lester, he had a reputation of coming in. He would drink heavily. He would come into Eaton's or come into the village and just walk up and down the aisle shouting poetry, ranting, just doing what he did. That was his type of personality. Telling people, is my work worth money to you?
Yeah.
And they would give him money sometimes just to make him leave, I believe.
Right. Now, both Rick and Lester, they became published poets. They actually did get their work
Did. Lester had his first book published in 1958. He had a second book published in 1968. And I have had difficulty finding any books in between. Rick, on the other hand, did have several chapbooks of poetry published. Most of them were published locally. He probably had 8 or 10 total. But Rick apparently wrote hundreds of poems. Not all of them got published. Many of them he just gave away. When he was sitting in the back of the village writing, someone would sit down near him. He would strike up a conversation with them, usually a young woman. He was a bit of a lech that way. And after the conversation, he would write a poem and give it to them.
Right.
He wrote hundreds and hundreds of poems, and so very few of them got published, apparently.
To talk a little bit about his extracurricular activity, he also published several, we say, softcore pornography books?
Starting in the mid-60s, to support himself, he started writing under the pseudonym Jack Vast, V-A-S-T, and he started writing pornography. He wrote porno paperbacks for publishers like Saber Books and Satan Books and some other of those publishers back in the early 60s. It's funny, Rick was actually a VCU student in 1969 for a short while, and the Commonwealth Times, the VCU school newspaper, wrote an article about Rick in September of 1969, and they said, Rick is an English major, and he has over 200 books to it. He has 30 prose books to his credit, without saying that those books were pornography. So they probably didn't know.
Yeah, what were some of the titles of those
prose books? There was one called Everybody Wins, and that's one I found and now own. One was called Passion's Greatest Trap. One was called Sex Marathon. They were just potboiler porno books.
Yeah, yeah, quickie
stuff. Yeah, that you could make a few hundred dollars on and move on, write the next one. I did read one of them. I read one called Everybody Wins. And I got to tell you, 50 Shades of Grey was much more pornographic than that book.
Okay, yeah.
Well, remember, this is the mid-60s.
Yeah, so sometimes the covers were more lurid than what you got inside.
Absolutely. The covers were lurid because the publishers knew and the bookstore owners knew that somebody would come in and buy a book based on the cover. And then even though the book stinks, they're not going to bring it back get their money back.
So what happened on the evening of April 10th, 1983?
April the 8th, 1983. What happened was Rick got a job. He only held one job in his life, as far as we can tell, for more than a year. And that was the job he had working in B&T Bookstore, which is the 1203 West Broad Street, the adult bookstore that was there. And Rick,
what would be there now?
It's a parking lot now.
Okay.
And there's a yogurt place or a smoothie place right next door now.
Okay.
So Rick got that job. He worked the second shift. He worked 4 to 11. So his job at 11 o'clock every night was to close up, lock the place up, and go home. This one particular night on April the 8th, 1983, Rick was sweeping up. He was getting ready to close at around 11 p.m., and that's when things get fuzzy. Either someone was hiding out in one of the video booths in the back, or he let someone in the door, but there was no sign of forced entry into the bookstore that night. According to rumor, Rick was stripped naked. He was taken back into the bathroom, and he was stabbed to death. We don't know if it was once, twice, or 40 times.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that Rick was given a pocket knife on his 40th birthday by his friend Lester. Apparently, it sounds like that was the very knife used to kill him.
Yeah.
His killer, for some inexplicable reason, remained inside the bookstore all night.
Mm.
At 7 o'clock the next morning, the day manager, Ed Henderson, showed up. Henderson confronted the assailant. The assailant robbed him, bound and gagged him to a chair, and then stole Henderson's car. The car was later discovered at Bow and Broad Streets, just a couple blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
Ed was able to get himself out of his... out of the ropes or cord. I think he was tied up with an electric cord. He ran to the Village restaurant, told them what happened. They called the police. He met the police back at B&T Bookstore, and that's when he discovered Rick dead in the bathroom.
Wow.
He had been tied up with the cord of a wall clock that had been stopped at 11:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
So there was speculation that that's the time that he was murdered.
Right. And what happened from that point on? From what you could gather, was there a full police investigation of this? What was the reaction?
There was an investigation. There were two detectives who looked into the case. Nothing came from the case other than the fact that there was a robbery. The police report said it was a robbery. And the Times-Dispatch and the News Leader reported it as a simple robbery. But none of that can be confirmed.
Yeah, and there's an awful lot of really strange details.
There's a lot of strange detail. For one, there was speculation from someone at the time, one of Rick's friends, that this was a revenge killing, that Rick had been arrested prior to his murder, maybe dropped a couple of names of suppliers possibly, and this person came back as a revenge motive. That could not be confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
It could not be confirmed that Rick was arrested prior to his murder.
Mm-hmm.
We can't even confirm if he was stabbed or even shot. Now, Ed Henderson reported to the detective and to the Times-Dispatch that the assailant who he opened the door to that morning had a gun.
Huh.
So But the gun was not used, mm-hmm. as far as we can tell. So why would he have a gun and not use it? We don't know. If mm-hmm. it was robbery, was the motive.
Right.
Mr. Henderson was not shot or injured. We don't know why that's the case.
Right.
We don't know why the assailant stayed in the bookstore for 8 hours killing Rick mm-hmm. and then leaving when it was daylight, when he could have left under the cover of darkness.
Well, you recently contacted the Richmond police about the case. What did they tell you? What did you find out from them?
I asked the police cold case unit to reopen the case, or at least look into the case. I was trying to get some answers to some of these questions. It was looked at by the cold case unit, but they came back and said, we're sorry. They did tell me that the investigation appeared to be incomplete, but he would not specify if the detective's original notes were missing or if something was just left out. There's no way of knowing that. The detective who looked into it recently in February told me that only 3 people know what really happened that night, and one of them is dead. The other one is the assailant and the mm-hmm. detective.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I would be told. He said releasing any other details of the case might taint the investigation.
Hmm.
So that's just what
we're... The 30-year-old investigation.
A 30-year-old investigation that I am fairly certain no one has taken a look at. Mm-hmm. Probably in most, if not all, of that.
Did you get anything from them? Did you get any papers or any information from them at all?
No, I could not get anything from them at all.
Right.
So they just shut it down.
Talk about how this was all reported. Was there much in the press about it? I seem to recall you mentioned the Throttle article.
Right. Well, right at the time of the death, there was a short article in the Times-Dispatch about a murder in an adult bookstore. They named Rick and a couple of sketchy details about robbery being the motive, et cetera. The news leader ran a short piece the next day, basically reiterating the same information. That was the end of it. There was not even an obituary.
Wow.
There was no family mm-hmm. around. We mm-hmm. couldn't. There was no family to be found to write an obituary. So that was the end of the mainstream press. There was absolutely nothing after that. In October of 1983, that's when a young journalism student named Donald Wilson wrote an excellent article about the murder of Rick that was run on the cover of Throttle. And that was sort of the basis of the article that I wrote now. He had gotten some quotes from some people who are dead now, like Lester Blackiston. Lester passed away in 2007. So naturally, I couldn't interview him, but Donald had interviewed him at the time.
Talk about him, his friend Lester, and how there could maybe perhaps be a connection between Lester and Rick's death.
This is really something that...
Speculative, I know.
It's speculative and is really not something that I strongly considered based on their friendship. Mm-hmm. Lester and Rick did have a very strong friendship. Now, not knowing either one of them, especially at the end, Lester was, when he would drink heavily, he would get very volatile, and
right.
he would pull a gun, and someone even told me they saw him shoot someone at a party, simply because he was just wound up. He kept a Bible, yeah. apparently, that the center of the Bible had been cut completely out, and he kept his pistol in that. And this person,
Robert Mitchum style.
Kind of Robert Mitchum style.
Yeah.
And this person said they saw him open that Bible, take the gun out, and shoot it through the roof of his houseboat.
Right.
And Lester liked to flash a pocket knife in someone's face. He had mm-hmm. he had a pretty good sized knife. He liked to pull that out and just flash it in front of someone's face just to see their reaction.
Right.
That was the kind of person he was. It would be completely speculative to think that Lester had anything to do mm-hmm. with the death. I don't know the status of their friendship right at the end, but I would think a lot of people may dispute that notion.
Right.
I was told Roy Scherer, who used to live here in town, did tell me that he thought there were 3 suspects in the murder. The police detective that I spoke to did confirm to me there's no evidence that there were 3 suspects.
Mm, okay.
We have no idea. I don't know how many there were,
right.
but he did say there were not 3.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about about the scene, because that's fascinating to me. And I guess it would fascinate anyone who thinks that the underground in Richmond just started, yesterday.
Yeah, I don't think anybody realizes that Richmond had a very vibrant, very strong underground scene in the late 50s. There were a lot of beat poets, a lot of characters. The RPI Art School had a lot to do with that.
Now, RPI became VCU.
RPI, which became VCU,
yeah.
Right. The Art School really created an environment where it was almost like the circus, because people tell me that sometimes what they called rednecks full of in cars would drive down through VCU or through the RPI area just looking to pick a fight with some of the weirdos that they would see. And these people would stake out the village. The village was really an amazing melting pot because in one corner you'd have the leftists, in one corner you'd have the Marxists, you'd have the painters in one poet, in one corner, the poets in another corner.
Right.
So everybody was staking out and pontificating on their own pet causes inside the village. And Etons to an extent too, but in just in a different demographic. But apparently in 1959, and I learned this by talking to Dr. Edward Peoples, apparently 85% of all of Richmond's felony arrests occurred in the 800-900 block of West Gray Street. And I have no reason to dispute that, even though I have not statistically checked it, but the police were after the RPI students.
Yeah.
They really were the vice squad.
They were the outsiders. They were the weirdos.
That's right.
The troublemakers. Yeah.
So if anything came up, the first place they went was the RPI Gray Street corridor. And I have no reason to believe they really were quite harassing. What has struck me from that period, from the late 50s up into the early 70s, really, was just the breathtaking levels of overkill that the police would use, the drug busts. One person told me recently in the early 1960s that he was in bed asleep when Lieutenant Higgins of the vice squad broke down the door of his apartment and they frisked him while he was completely naked, just looking for pot. You know, and this happened over and over and over. I've gotten stories from numerous people that all tell the same story, that the vice squad broke into their apartment in the middle of the night. That was their M.O. And dump everything in the middle of the floor, dump the mattress, dump the bookshelves, dump everything out just looking for pot. And if they didn't find anything, they would just leave and say, well, you were lucky this time.
Right.
it was astonishing.
Right. Well, this scene, talk a little bit. I know we're going to have you back on when your book comes out. But talk a little bit about all of the countercultural magazines and media that were available at the time.
That's another part of Richmond that no one realizes, and this has been the most fascinating part. My book actually starts chronicling counterculture media in Richmond starting in 1960. In 1960 and 61, Dr. Peoples came out with his news sheet, The Ghost. And then there was a bit of a dry spell, but then in 1967, Art Durow and a handful of people started The Sunflower, which was a biweekly tabloid that reflected hippie culture. This is on the heels of the Haight-Ashbury Summer of Love. The first issue of The Sunflower appeared in October of 67. It came out for about a year. A very strong hippie presence was growing in Richmond at the time, especially once again down in the 800-900 blocks of West Gray Street. There was a coffee shop down there called Grant's Tomb, which is where Chipotle is today. Grant's Tomb, they had a lot of poetry readings there, a lot of art shows. Once again, the police were constantly coming into the place, looking for drugs, looking for anything they could to shut the place down.
Yeah, there was constantly a club at Laurel and Broad.
Laurel and Broad. Yeah. Now, that's another fascinating...
You could do a whole history of just that one...
That one building.
Yeah.
And actually, that one building, and this is where Rick Davis comes in, too... right there at Laurel and Broad, which is now the Empire, that was where Free University was located. In September of 1969... The brand new VCU Student Government Association gave $2,200 to a group of people to start Free University. Now, free universities were pretty common starting around 1967 on the West Coast. And there was just a chance for people to start a class and go in and learn something at night. There was no accreditation. There were no credit, no grades, no credits, no nothing. It was just a place to go at night and learn something.
Right.
Rick Davis taught a poetry class at Free University right there at Laurel and Broad. It was called Rocks and Concrete. Was the title of the class. I don't know what that meant exactly. I'm sure it had to do with the type of poetry that he was teaching. There was another class taught by a man named Reed Cornwell called Emotional Hang-Ups. I would love to have seen the syllabus
Several
for that
people
one.
People associated with this show could use that
That's
class.
Right. That's true. Now, most free universities, especially on the West Coast, were very heavily leftist political in their course offerings. Here at VCU, that was not the case. Or here in Richmond, it was mostly interpersonal awareness type of programs, like
self-help.
Emotional hang-ups, more self-help stuff. Right. There was also one thing, too, that would happen at Free University. They had, you could take a class for $2. It wasn't free. Despite the name, the free had more to do with the learning style.
Yeah.
But for $2, you could take a course, and for $20, You could take as many courses as you wanted. You could go to all the movies that they showed on Friday nights and any concerts that they had.
Right.
And one of those, some of the times those concerts featured a band called Steel Mill.
Oh, I know where you're going on this.
Yeah. And another one called Child, both of which had a rather scruffy-looking, long-haired guitarist named Bruce Springsteen.
Right, right.
When Free University folded in March of 1970, Steel Mill with Bruce Springsteen played a benefit concert to help them pay off their debt.
Oh, wow. Okay.
To the VCU Student Government Association, which they did. They were able to pay it off.
Uh-huh.
And they had a little bit of money left over to give to the brand new Radical Student Union, which was just forming at the time.
Well,
so,
another Springsteen story. Thank you.
yeah.
Hey, do you think that we'll ever solve the death of Rick Davis?
One thing I wish is if there's people out there who know something or who even suspect something, I would like to see them come forward and come to the police and say, hey, here's what I heard at the time.
And the police say that they're ready to listen, right?
They're ready to listen. They are. Yeah. The detective told me, he said, if someone has information that may be pertinent, to bring it forward, and they will look at it. So that would be great. If anyone would know something or suspect something, just bring it out. That's the closest we'll come. Rick deserves it. You know, Rick, what happened, he suffered some indignities after death. His ashes, his body was cremated. His ashes were put in storage on Grove Avenue. And when that storage unit was sold, his ashes and everything in that storage unit went to the dump. Mm. So even after death, the guy got no respect, a final indignity. Oh, so it'd be great to be able to put some closure to this case in that way. Yes.
Well, you're listening to Open Source RVA. I'm Don Harrison, and my guest has been Dale Brumfield. Dale wrote the cover story in Style Weekly this week about the unsolved murder of poet Rick Davis. It's a great piece and a nice piece of detective work. The issue's on the stands now, or you can go online and see it at styleweekly.com. Hey, thanks, Dale, as always.
Thank you, Don. Good to be here.
Are you my main man? Are you now? Are you now? Are you my main man? Are you now? Are you now? Are you now?
Do you know what to do if you find an injured hawk or owl? It is illegal for an unauthorized person to interfere with a raptor, even if it is injured. Only a person with appropriate rehabilitation permits or an authorized government employee may possess, handle, or rehabilitate raptors. Even a veterinarian may hold a raptor only until it is medically stable. If you see a raptor that appears to be injured, orphaned, or ill, please call the Raptor Conservancy of Virginia or another qualified source before trying to assist the bird. An injured raptor will defend itself with its talons, putting you at risk of injury. You may contact the RCV at 703-578 1175 or by email at raptorsva@aol.com. For more information, visit www.raptorsva.org.
Lisa Tirano is not from here, and as of Monday, she won't even be here. Tirano is the founder and driving force behind Tricycle Gardens, arguably the first when it was founded in 2002 in what has become a citywide, region-wide trend and obsession with locally sourced food. Tirano eventually was forced out of that organization after it became popular as a corporate philanthropic effort, and her own passion for ecological activism became uncomfortable for some on the increasingly corporate board. Now, after a number of years working to further her beliefs that our planet is worth a little effort, even at the local level, Tirano is off to greener pastures. Her message, sadly ignored here in her adopted hometown, has found receptive ears further afield. So I'm with Lisa Tirano, who is about to leave us. Richmond is losing, I think, a very important voice here. So we're having our exit interview. Lisa, thank you for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And maybe just start at the beginning. Can you tell me what brought you here in the first place? You're not from Richmond.
No, I'm not from Richmond. I actually was conceived in London. and born in New Jersey, and 3 weeks later was off to California. But I ended up in Richmond in 91 after graduating from architecture school at Virginia Tech. Had some friends here, and I knew it was a very inexpensive place to live, and I wanted to be an artist, not an architect. And I knew there was cheap warehouse studio space, so I moved up here with some friends, and we got a studio and made art and enjoyed an amazing music scene in Richmond, and it was a lot of fun.
And you were talking a little bit about that before the show, about the music scene, that you were really drawn to it. What was it about the music scene? What were you listening to at that time?
I think I remember MC 900 Foot Jesus played the week I got
them?
Here
yeah.
at what's now the Empire. I can't remember what that was called in 91.
Was it the Metro?
Yeah. And it just seemed like there was great music all the time going on. And that was a big part of my life, was going out to see music.
So it really was the music scene in Richmond that drew you to Richmond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is funny, we're talking to you about leaving Richmond, and we'll get into it later, I guess, just sort of the creative crush. But the Richmond music scene has seen quite a few of those over the years.
The music scene and the cheap warehouse space. And the cheap living. I paid $175 a month rent when I first
Not
moved
bad.
Here. Yeah, and we and for a huge apartment.
So now you decided to become an artist, and in fact, you were self-sufficient as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
But you had gone to school to be an architect.
Mm-hmm. What's that
Whoops.
About?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I love design, and I always will, and I love architecture, and I love buildings. I'm just not somebody that can sit still for very long. I like to have a physical life. I like to build and create and actually see what I am having in my mind's eye or what I'm visioning. And even now, I have a standing desk. I don't sit down. And I've had a standing desk now for about 5 years. And I just, sitting down for long periods of time is a quick passage to full-on malaise.
Are you a self-trained artist, or is this something that you...
Yes, yeah, I've taken a handful of classes, but I would think it's more that I come from a design background that I've applied to the materials that I've used.
Now, real quick, before we kind of get on into the deeper stuff here, where are you going? That's not deeper stuff.
Monday morning at 7:30 a.m., April Fool's Day, getting in my car, and I'm heading up to the Catskill Mountains to work in service of the Dalai Lama. At a place called the Menla Mountain Retreat, which is part of Columbia University's Tibet House and Tibetan Studies program.
And we are going to find out this is an April Fool's joke and you're staying, right?
Nope. I already have gas in the tank.
So how did you come by this? We were talking a little bit about this over the last couple of weeks. This really was kind of serendipity, wasn't it?
At the end of last summer, after I'd worked for the city of Richmond, which was a very eye-opening and despair-causing experience for me.
We'll get to that.
Okay. I went up to a place called the Omega Institute to do a 5-day yoga immersion with a style that I've been practicing for a while called Jivamukti. And the Omega Institute is in Rhinebeck.
I don't know what any of that is.
But. So it's up in the Hudson River Valley.
Okay.
And it's a very physically intense form of yoga, but it's also a form of yoga that believes that yoga does not exist until you take it off the mat, and it's how you live your life, and that yoga is activism, that it doesn't matter if you're the best physical yogi in the world, that if you are not living a life of... meaningful and honest work, kindness, having a physical practice, meditation, things along those lines, then it doesn't really matter how great you are with your asana or your postures of your yoga practice.
So this is like a combo of like the Ashtanga and some sort of like one of these other yoga practices that's more of just be good to your fellow man.
Right. It's not quite as physical as Ashtanga, which, by the way, was designed for 13-year-old boys that were about to enter the Indian military. You can edit the stuff out.
Okay. Oh, no, there ain't no editing, Lisa.
But, you know, I went into that into this 5-day yoga retreat really just kind of wrecked from the fact that activism is not supported in Richmond. That true activism in this city is met with a real dismissal. And I went up to this 5-day yoga immersion and for the first time in years felt really supported in my work as an activist. And really could own the fact that I am an environmental activist and an ecological activist. And I did not, and I was embraced for that. I wasn't seen as a gadfly or as a provocateur or as a troublemaker or as somebody who was to be afraid of. But I was actually really supported in the work that I did. And that was really a big deal for me. And I realized that I couldn't be myself in Richmond given the tone of this city.
Now, that, you've gained a little bit of, in certain quarters, that reputation of being this provocateur. But you really haven't changed since we've known you in Richmond. I mean, you arrived on the scene, or I guess after, and again, we were talking before the broadcast, you kind of got into the volunteerism, literally through volunteerism at Chimborazo Elementary, doing mm-hmm. reading. And decided that you needed to take that next step, and really did take a next step with, again, I guess where everybody knows you is Tricycle Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of anything that is much more physical and put your back into it, but at the same time also very much focused on trying to bring community together to accomplish something, mm-hmm. activism.
Right. Well, I don't think I've changed. I've probably become stronger as an activist, but I think as the work I did became recognized and noticed, and as the food movement has become more mainstream, and we started to needed to raise more money, and we're doing more work, and started to get attention of more of the corporate class, that's when the problems began, is that this work is asking for a dramatic paradigm shift on how we treat the planet and how we treat each other, and the corporate class is not comfortable in that yet.
They like to talk about it seems like, or some of that class here in Richmond likes to talk about it, but they seem a little uncomfortable with action.
Yes, they do seem uncomfortable with action.
I don't know how else to put it other than that, but Tricycle Gardens really was your first community project, right? I mean, that really jumped in and that was it, and it mm-hmm. was kind of ahead of the curve in terms of some of this food movement or the locavore mm-hmm. food movement.
Right.
And
for me, it's also very much of an environmental and ecological activism, not just food, because you are what you eat, right? And as we are destroying our planet, we are destroying ourselves. We are the same. We're not separate. We're not disconnected. And I think one of the more heartbreaking symbols of this is the Sunny Supermarket up on 25th Street.
Yeah.
Which just sold crap food for years. And now it's a dialysis center. You know, you can't stop a moving train. And there's the diabetes business.
It's like full circle there, isn't it?
Yeah, diabetes business is $300 billion a year. You know, it's very complicated stuff.
Can you tell us, real briefly, where did the name Tricycle Gardens come from?
Well, very early on, I had this image of more kids being involved as entrepreneurs and growing food and taking it down to the farmer's market. And because we were on Churchill, so I thought, you know, you get these big trikes like the adults ride mm-hmm. and stuff that full of veggies and roll down the hill and sell it at the farmer's market. Yeah. And, you know, it's that whole thing of you buy a packet of seeds for $1.99 and you can grow $500 worth of food. Now, that sounds like a bargain.
You'd have had a fairly high mortality rate sending people racing right. down Church Hill on those bikes.
I know. They just want their
good
one
thing
speed.
That didn't happen.
So there's something that sounds really lovely about Tricycle Gardens and just the whole idea of three, the cycle of three, and it worked really well with...
Magic number.
Yeah, the magic number. It worked really well with the way we wrote our mission statement and our programs, and visually it was just it worked.
Ahead of its time, how did it balloon from what you explained to me was just a couple of friends who sort of got together, paid in $50 a piece, and came up with about $300 to buy seeds and supplies, mm-hmm. et cetera, to something that was much bigger, that is well known.
Well, we applied for a grant with the Robbins Foundation, and the Robbins Foundation has been extremely generous with Tricycle Gardens, and I believe continues to be. And so we went from basically, you know, a few hundred dollars, we got a grant for $40,000. And that really kicked it off from there. And then, you know, we started to get more attention and more funding. And then my role basically turned into a combination of being a development director and an executive director and the design director, the creative director. And it just, from my comfort level, moved too far into the fundraising. And so much of my life and my energy was around raising money to the point where even where if I was around friends of mine who I knew had resources, what would be going through my mind is, I wonder how much money they have. Do they think I'm thinking about their money? Huh, I'm thinking about their money. But they're my friends. I shouldn't be thinking about their money. But I wonder how much money they might give me.
So you were on that tricycle going down Broad Street,
yeah,
and didn't know how to stop.
And it wasn't a place I'm comfortable in.
So what changed? There was a moment. It was a sort of a painful moment where you were no longer with Tricycle.
Well, I think, you know, I as the board became a little bit less of the founding board and more of a fundraising board, I was told a number of times that I needed to tone myself down, that I shouldn't talk about this from an environmental standpoint. I once was told that I used the word ecology too often, and that was offensive to some people. I remember at one point talking about a dung
ecology,
beetle.
Ecology, it's sort of like a four-letter word.
Yeah, right. Talking about the role of a dung beetle.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's also a scarab beetle, which is considered mm-hmm. sacred in the Egyptian culture. And, you know, it's a remarkable little creature, what a dung beetle does. But that, I remember this woman just being so entirely offended and coming up to me and just saying, you know, I don't know who you think you are.
This is a board member?
No. This was at an event, but a board member overheard it. And this was probably somebody with some ability to...
Clout.
Yeah, some clout. And so things like that just started to happen, and I just realized that it's a dung beetle.
It's a humble dung beetle, but it's one that has a something of an imperial role, I guess.
Yes.
It's kind of a neat story.
And so I think, you know, part of what I've understood now about this city is that we are not at a point of understanding the ecological crisis that we face, not just as a city of Richmond, but globally. And I was recently in a meeting with another project that I've been trying to launch, and I've realized that it's just not going to work here in Richmond. And I think it could potentially change the face of Richmond. There are hundreds of old tobacco warehouses on the south side. They're sitting vacant.
This is a very cool idea. You've told me a little bit about it.
They're sitting vacant. You take that metal skin off. You replace it with a greenhouse-grade plexi or polycarbonate or partially glass. and you can start producing enormous amounts of food, enormous amounts
and
of food.
And right now, these are brownfields. These are areas that really have not found any reasonable redevelopment. There's some ecological problems with, not to use that word again, but...
Yeah, you know, turn the warehouses of death into warehouses of life. And so I was in a meeting recently with some potential funders, and one of them actually told me that my language around ecological system services and ecological accounting scared him. He didn't like the language I was using, and he walked out of the meeting. And another person
just
in the
got meeting, up and left.
Got up and left. And another person in the meeting, when I was talking about ocean acidification being a potential, you know, the ocean acidification, if you are studying ecological collapse, is a biggie. And
you want to explain very briefly?
So the oceans have been absorbing carbon dioxide. They're the main sink of carbon dioxide. They're also heating up faster than the rest of the planet. As they become more acidic, it's starting to break down the coral reef systems because the calcium cannot form. And the oceans are the main producers of oxygen. Parts of it are starting to they're not shutting down yet, but they're very, very close to shutting down as the oceans become more acidic. I'm not a scientist, so I can't explain to you at a technical level what's happening, but they believe that it will tip like a canoe, like in you're in a canoe and you're tipping, all of a sudden you just flip.
Once the water starts to fill in, you're done.
It's over. And if this happens to our oceans, our main source of oxygen is going to be cut off. And it doesn't matter, you know, it doesn't matter how much money you have. You're not going to be able to buy oxygen.
So now we live in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, and you're explaining this to this person who's one of the other people that you're trying to convince of this idea, and he has a reaction that's not positive?
Well, he just says he doesn't understand why I'm talking about it, he doesn't know. He thinks it doesn't have anything to do with him, and he has nothing to do with that. He can't impact it, and it doesn't impact him. So there's sort of this idea that, I'll just say that to me, the level of leadership, the level of ignorance in our leadership and in the city, in the government as well, is shocking to me. That there is such a not a misunderstanding, but a non-understanding of what is happening with this ecological crisis that we are entering quickly into, or we are in it.
It's a big issue to deal with some local yokel, so to speak, no matter how much money he has, to present him with, you know, the weight of the world is on your shoulders. Mm-hmm. Was it just too much to ask?
Probably, yeah. I guess I'm not very good at presenting the information in a softer manner.
Now, you started to talk about this earlier. I don't know. I've listened to your ideas, and I think they're relatively convincing. You had talked a little bit about working though with the city, and that was an equally frustrating experience recently.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. I was working with the Mayor's Youth Academy, working with high school juniors and seniors, and with the Urban Gardening Program. And I gotta say, I loved working with the kids for the most part. They were awesome. There were some rotten ones, but these high school juniors and seniors, that demographic, I really enjoy working with, and for the most part, I think they really liked me. It was the administrative part of it was really hard. I was accused by Dr. Graham of encouraging slavery.
And this is Dr. Carolyn Graham now, ta-ta, after having her own issues come up. I guess her past came back to haunt her a little bit.
And so, you know, and it was really hard sitting in these meetings and being accused of, you know, sort of being an elitist around food and...
Literally accused you of enslaving the kids who were working on this program.
It got to me, yes. Yeah, or of encouraging slavery by teaching them to garden and working out, you know, in farming. Even though this was so small scale, you can't even...
We have a mutual friend who explained it and you were saying this before we talked on air here, that it's the best, in, or excuse me, it's the worst of both communities, both the African-American community and the white community in Richmond that sort of leads us.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that?
You know, I feel like there's sort of three worlds that exist here. Well, there's multiple, but I'm going to simplify it. There is the public sector, which is the government. There's the private sector, which is more the philanthropic class. And then there's the third, the creative class, if you will. I don't care for that phrase, but the thing is that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of brilliant, educated, aware, enlightened people in this city. But the stranglehold that the public sector and the private sector has on decision making and leadership in this town leaves no room for the other group of people that are here. And I think that the other group doesn't have a race divide like the public sector and the private sector does. But because there is the deep wounds of slavery and the deep wound of guilt happening that has not been recovered, and I'm not the only, I mean, many people will say this. The fact that we have...
This is the reason right now that we're looking at our past, the slave burial ground with the slave trail,
mm-hmm.
And some of the efforts of Dr. Ed Ayers at University of Richmond with the History of Richmond's Future or whatever his program is called is all around this idea of trying to heal these wounds, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're very deep.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
These are difficult things to get over.
It is. It's the collective consciousness of the city, and I don't have an answer. I really thought that gardening together and trying to create beautiful public spaces as a community might be a part of the solution. But I've also realized that, sadly, because of the legacy of agriculture in the Black community is essentially slavery, there's a lot of resentment. And it's understandable. You know, why would they want to get out and work growing food when that's... was part of the history of slavery. I also think within the white community that there's this idea that gardening is something that people that can't do anything else do, that dumb people do, that, you know, the hick or whatever, that there's not a level of... farmers are the smartest people you're going to meet. They know about botany, biology, climates... you know, soil chemistry,
microclimates.
Yeah, microclimates. They know the biology at an intimate level of botany of multiple kinds of plants. They know how to run businesses. They're entrepreneurs. They work harder than anybody you're ever going to meet, and they're passionate about what they do. But there's still this idea that they're not valued. They're invisible. They're an invisible part of the fact that we all eat three meals a day, but it's still an invisible thing, and people don't... The $1 hamburger is seen as a real victory.
You know? Well, you drive right on through, and you come out, and there it is. So you're obviously not going to be dropping by the drive-through line on your way out of Richmond, I'm assuming.
No.
Pick up your Happy Meal and head out.
I was thinking I might get a proper pie for the road.
There you go. Are you happy to be leaving Richmond, or is there...
Oh, there's been some tears, for sure. I love my community here. I think there's amazing, passionate, beautiful people here. But I have incredible opportunities that have been presented to me, and... I need to go where I can expand, where I'm valued, where I don't have to tone myself down, and where I can work. I can really work, where I can do the work. I like to work. I love to work. I like to work hard. I like to get dirty. I like to design things. I like to be clean. I like to work, and I like to see progress.
Well, somebody else, I guess, gets to see your progress in the future. Lisa Toronto, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Sad to see you go.
Oh, I'll be back to visit.
Yeah, whatever. We'll see you soon, hopefully.
Thank you. And WRIR rocks!
Where's my many color, semi-precious, plastic Easter egg?
And that's our show for March 29th, 2013. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi. Our guest engineer is Andrew Hawes, and our researcher is Jonathan Cunningham. Mike McKenzie's wardrobe is courtesy of Botany 500. Hey, we're finally getting all of those missing podcasts up. Honest. Just go to rvaopensource.com and start the downloads. For everyone here at Open Source RVA, we wish you a happy Easter, complete with all of that hollowed-out chocolate bunny stuff you desire. We'll see you next week on another edition of Open Source RVA.
Those lovely things, I miss them so. You ought to know by now. Those lovely things, I need them close. They rule my life somehow. Many-colored, semi-precious, plastic Easter egg. Where's my early English, Russian influence, porcelain caviar spoon? Well, where's my early English, Russian influence, porcelain caviar spoon? You borrowed last week, you'll get a smack. If you don't give it back. Where's my precast concrete, handmade cufflinks, smuggled from Japan? Yes, where's my precast concrete, handmade cufflinks, smuggled from Japan, that I lend to you on condition that give 'em right back. Those lovely things, I miss them so. You ought to know by now. Those lovely things, I need them close. They rule my life somehow. Many-colored, semi-precious, plastic Easter egg. A green-eyed mojo, praying mantis, antique rosewood dice. My early English, Russian influence, porcelain caviar spoon, thick as concrete, handmade cufflinks, smuggled from Japan.